listening to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette, episode 58. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette. That's me, the podcast that's filled with refreshingly honest conversations about the wonderful mess of being human. More than anything, this show is home to honest conversations between real people. We're not trying to sell you anything. We're not trying to get you to fix yourself or fix your life or do any life hacks or anything like that. Instead, it's a space to just be real, to take a deep breath and talk about all the behind-the-scenes stuff that I think isn't talked about enough, like our fears and challenges, our insecurities, our secret dreams, how it really feels to try and make changes in your life, what happens when you don't accomplish a goal, and just the day-to-day truths of being human in a crazy world. As your host, it's so much fun for me to sit down with everyone from athletes, writers, and entrepreneurs to parents, coaches, world travelers, adventurers, artists, the list goes on, and to then get to bring those conversations to you. And fair warning real quick that this is an adult podcast, which means we often cover adult topics and use adult language. So don't say you weren't warned. My hope for you as a listener of this show is that it makes you laugh, think, and just feel less alone. Because to be honest, that's all that I ever want, to know that I'm not alone. Something else that's unique about this show is that it's now 100% community supported, which means no ads, no sponsors, no trying to sell you anything, no outside influence, just us here together sharing stories. The show is made possible by listeners like you, who have pledged $8 or more per 8-episode season. To do this, we use a platform called Patreon. And not only does your support go toward the funding goal we need to hit in order to keep the show going beyond the end of 2016, but your support also earns you access to exclusive bonus content. That bonus content includes conversations and interviews with wonderful guests that aren't aired publicly. Plus, you get access to the Squad Pod, a shorter version of Real Talk Radio, where the guests are you, the members of the community. Everyone who supports the show with a pledge of $8 or more has the chance to be a guest on the Behind the Scenes podcast, which then airs exclusively just to our little community. It's an incredible way for us to really get to know each other, and I'm beyond excited about the months ahead and the chance to get to know you, for real, through this way of doing things. As of right now, you can get over 20 hours of bonus content by going to patreon.com/Nicole Antoinette. That's patreon.com/Nicole Antoinette. And at the end of this episode, you'll actually get to meet one of our community members who joins me for a quick and hilarious game of Would You Rather and shares why she loves supporting the show on Patreon. So if you believe in this Real Talk revolution, like I do, and if you're in the position to be able to support the show, I can't tell you how much that would mean to me. Right now, the show is scheduled and funded through the end of 2016. And if we meet our funding goal by the end of the year, then it will be able to continue into 2017 too. And you can totally help make that happen. So thank you so much for the support. And now let's dive right into today's episode. Today, you'll get to meet Blair Braverman. Blair is a dog sledder and the author of Welcome to the Goddamn Ice Cube, a memoir of life in the Arctic that Outside Magazine called a new classic, and the New York Times said borders on sublime. Her writing has appeared on This American Life and in The Guardian, BuzzFeed, The Best Women's Travel Writing, and elsewhere. She lives with her fiancé and 18 huskies on a farm in the Wisconsin Northwoods, where she is currently training for the Iditarod, an 1,100-mile dog sled race across Alaska. In this episode, Blair teaches me all about dog sledding, something I did not know anything about before this. She shares stories about training, racing, what it's like to live with 20 or so dogs. She talks about her time living in the Arctic, what it's like to go 70 plus days where the sun doesn't rise, how it feels to be one of, if not the only female, in a male-dominated region and sport, and more. We also talk about her memoir, how it felt to write openly and honestly about experiencing sexual violence, and she shares her thoughts on writing, on how to handle writer's block, and about the importance of writing what's true. I'm fascinated by Blair's life and work, and it was wonderful to hear from someone whose day-to-day life is so totally different from mine. I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. Awesome. We are good to go. Blair, welcome to the show.
Hello.
It is so fun to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy we connected.
So set the scene for me. Tell me about the first hour or so of your day today. What did you do? What did you eat? All the good details about what's going on in your corner of the world this morning.
Okay. Well, my fiance came home at like 4 a.m. because he went to get groceries. He went to the nearest Trader Joe's, which is 3 hours away. And got sort of caught up. So I got up like when he was going to bed, made some coffee. I usually let the dogs wake up. Right now I have 12 adult-sized dogs. I have 12 full-grown huskies, and I have to count. I have 11 puppies here.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I try not to disturb them before they wake up on their own, but when they start stirring, I go out and, you know, make sure everyone has water for the day, especially because it's hot. Let the puppies out because they are in their pen and they just have so much energy. And they're like, we need to chase chickens. We need to like fall into a creek. We need to do everything all at once. So I did breakfast. I checked Twitter. And then I went and let the puppies out, and I'm teaching them not to jump, but my legs look like, I don't even know, like pinstriped from having them like scratch me so much in their excitement. So it's just like, okay, I have to wait out this stage in terms of training. And, you know, I brought some food and bones and took them for a walk to the river. And they're getting a little braver. They actually, a couple of them crossed it this time. I was really proud. And, then I came back and our neighbor was over here to talk about welding something. And now it's time for this.
Yeah, that is not what I did this morning. Oh my God. How do you train 11 puppies at the same time? That sounds like the most crazy making situation.
Well, they're not all going to be mine. I'm keeping most of them, but, we're dividing the litter between three different kennels. So I'll probably have six, at the end of it, but they're really just, they have to play, they have to run. And the really important thing is that they learn to like all follow me and be oriented toward me. So I let them all loose and then I have to like sprint out of the yard. I live on a farm. We used to be on a dirt road, but they just paved it. I have to like sprint to the road so the puppies think I'm more exciting than the chickens and they don't start chasing the chickens, which will make the roosters very angry. So I get to the road, I crouch down, I give them all some treats the moment they sit down, you know, when their butt hits the cement. And then I just sort of have to power walk and they just orbit at very high speeds and bump into each other, and they love trash. If they can find like a bottle or a beer can or something on the side of the road, it just is like puppy heaven and they're so proud. And so right now they're walking about 45 minutes a day. And then as they get bigger, that's just going to get farther and farther. And the goal is, the reason I want them to have a lot of practice following me is that, you know, they'll be able to run loose with the team when the team goes out, the whole dog team. You know, I want to be able to, on road trips, if I'm at a weird place and I have to let all the dogs out to pee, I want to just let them loose. I don't want to be like walking everyone on a leash, you know? So I really just try to instill that in them early.
My God. Okay. I have so many questions for you. I like don't even know where to start. So, I mean, I literally know nothing about dog sledding. And I mean, I imagine that I'm not alone in that. And so I would love for you to educate me about it a little bit, maybe sharing some of the misconceptions, anything that you'd love for someone to know about your life and sport.
All right. I think, well, dog sledding is you take some huskies and you tie them to the front of a sled and then they pull you at its most basic. And it used to be a main form of transportation in Arctic regions. Now it's mostly recreational or competitive. And there's actually, I live in Wisconsin, there's a lot of dog sledding around here. It's a great community. And so I'll have a team, three dogs can easily pull me like many miles. But I typically will run anywhere from 6 to 14 at a time. And they get so excited. Like the best way to picture it, they're bred for this in the same way that retrievers are bred to retrieve. And I think that's the best parallel I'm able to make so people can picture it. Like when you pick up a tennis ball, if you have a dog that's really oriented toward tennis balls or sticks and they're just obsessed and like they will never stop running and catching that tennis ball. I grew up with labs, so that's what comes to mind. And that's how these huskies are for running. I mean, it is all they think about, and, you know, just they're so happy. They like other things. They like, you know, eating and playing and flirting, and they like being pet, and they like being brushed and all those things. But, like, running is where it's at. So it's finally getting cold enough. It has to be below 50 degrees so they don't overheat. And I actually did my first run of the season last week. There was a little girl up here from South Carolina, I think, who is sick. It's a sort of make-a-wish thing. And so we went out on a really nice run with her family, and they were just cracking up the whole time. And that was 4 miles. And by March, they're going to be doing 100 miles at a time. So they just, you know, it's like training for a marathon over the winter. They build up their endurance so fast. I mean, there's a lot of research into why these dogs are such special, incredible athletes, even compared to wild animals. And then they like take some time off in the summer. We brought our dogs up to Alaska where they hung out. It was cooler. And then we brought them back at the end of August, drove all the way back.
Okay, so now you're getting settled in for what winter will bring, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so tell me the story of how you first got into this. Like, where did this, I don't know, like, so just tell me all of it.
I'm from California, of course.
The land of all the dog sledding, clearly.
Exactly. And I lived in Norway when I was a kid, and I really wanted to go back. I loved cold places, and I ended up when I was 18, I went to a dog sledding boarding school 200 miles above the Arctic Circle. This like sort of strange socialist free boarding school that took only 40 students at a time, and like you weren't allowed to sleep inside for long periods of time, even though it was like 40 below. And so I was there for a year, and I loved it. I loved it, but I didn't know, you know, my visa was running out. I didn't know how I was going to be able to be involved in the sport when I got back. So from there, I went to Alaska for a couple summers and worked as a tour guide in the summer up there when I wasn't going to school. And, you know, that didn't totally work out. You know, I had like a shitty ex-boyfriend up in Alaska who I was trying to get away from. So for a couple years, I didn't do any dog sledding. And just 3 years ago, I got my own team because I moved onto my fiance's farm. So, and I'm 28, so it's been 10 years since I started.
So, okay, so you mentioned that you lived in Norway before you were 18. How did that come about?
My dad is a anti-tobacco researcher, and Norway was instituting a smoking ban in public buildings. So he was brought over there to consult with that project.
Okay. And what was it about your experience when you were there that made you think, yeah, I'm definitely going to come back here and go to this strange boarding school where I have to sleep outside in like the freezing weather?
I think the biggest thing for me, I mean, I was 10 when I first moved there. And I went from being, you know, my parents hated California. They were always saying, oh, we don't really live here, even though they'd been there for, you know, 15 years at that point. And suddenly I was in Oslo, which was where I lived, and I just had this total freedom. I mean, at that point, parents would leave their babies outside stores and restaurants, just like on the stoop, in their carriages for, you know, 2 hours. And they just knew like, oh, if they fuss, someone walking by will help them. Like it was such a different atmosphere. And so my parents gave me a ton of freedom. And it was the first place I felt like was mine because I was always out exploring with my friends and, you know, taking buses to the ends of their lines and going up into the woods and, you know, I think it became almost a kind of fantasy place for me in that way.
Interesting. So tell me about your first dog sled experience.
Oh, gosh. My first dog sled experience. And just to clarify, they pull wheels, right? They pull carts on wheels when there's no snow. So just so you can picture that too. But it must have been early on when I got to the school, the folk school, and my teacher was driving. He was a Sami man, you know, which is the native culture up there, a reindeer herding culture. And so he was driving and I was riding on the cart, and it just is amazing. I mean, anyone who has been dog sledding or to a race or something, they all remark on the sudden change, that it's just sort of chaos when the dogs are being harnessed and their tails are like whipping so hard and they're barking and they're so excited. And it's really overwhelming if you haven't had that before. Like, picture one dog getting super excited and then picture 20 of them. Or if there's a bunch of mushers together, like 200 dogs. It's really overwhelming when it's new. So I was a little shaken up by that. And then the moment they're able to run, the moment you, like, you know, there's like a knot. I don't know anything about knots. I don't know what it's called, but, you know, you untie them with a yank and they just go. It's like 0 to 20 miles per hour instantly, and then instant silence. And they're beautiful. And that was what struck me first. That's what I remember looking back on that. And then suddenly my teacher started cussing, and it turned out some sheep had come on the trail and the dogs started trying to hunt the sheep. So we had to, like, you know, pull them all around and go back and go again another day.
Oh my gosh. Okay. And so did you think, you know, this is something that I want to get into? Like, where did that transition come to that you decided it was something that you really wanted to pursue?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wouldn't say there was a moment. At the end of the year, I knew I wanted to continue, but I also had promised my dad I'd come back and go to college. And also, I mean, it's just such a, oh, my husky's walking around right now. Honey, go lie down. Go lie down. Good girl. One of my huskies. She has a bed right next to my desk.
That's so cute.
I don't know if you can hear her feet. Maybe she has to pee. Blame, lie down in your bed. Thank you. I forget. What was I saying? I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. About kind of the transition into deciding that you wanted to pursue this. And you said that your dad wanted you to come back and go to college.
Yeah. So it just, you know, I was going to college. I went to school for environmental law. And then later I got an MFA in nonfiction writing at the University of Iowa. So at those points in time, like, there was no question that I could have my own dogs. Or, oh, honey, go lie down. It's okay. I'm talking to someone who's not here, but it's just fine. So I was at school. I was living in apartments. I really didn't have a chance to have my own dogs, but I would track down dog sledders and, you know, beg to scoop poop in their kennels. I just wanted to be around them. And then when I graduated from my MFA, I actually moved up to northern Wisconsin and with my fiance, and he has a farm. He has 35 acres. And suddenly it was like possible. Suddenly I could conceive of having a few dogs here. We're right on the national forest. You know, there's networks of trails that go all the way to Minnesota and Michigan. And I'm about an hour north of Green Bay, if your listeners know where that is. So, and then, serendipitously, my old coworker called me up and said, hey, you know, my wife's having a baby. We're paring down our kennel. I have these 6 dogs. Actually, he said 5 dogs that I want to give to a good home altogether. And would you be interested? I know that you're living up here and you're involved in the dog sledding community. And so I was going to try them out for a couple weeks. I was going to bring them home and see if I liked having dogs. And of course, you know, once they got here, they were never going back. I fell immediately in love with them. So then I had a 6 dog team because 6 is the minimum for like racing and stuff, recreational races. So I asked for one more. I wanted to make sure I had a whole team. And I loved it. I mean, I was racing for the first time. And I think people can picture dog sled racing like greyhound racing or something, where people are like gambling or profiting off the dogs. And, you know, sometimes I wish I could profit off the dogs, but it's not like that. It's like, you know, normally you go out and you're alone on the trail. I mean, you're alone in the wilderness for hours. And it's a sport where the people are really far flung. And so if you go to a race, there's races around the Midwest, like that's a chance you get to be on a trail that's groomed. You get to hang out with all your mushing pals. You get to, like, you know, meet their dogs. Sometimes someone will have like your dog's siblings and you can reunite them. And, you know, and then when you're on the trail, every time you cross a road, there's volunteers standing there. Like, you don't have to worry about cars. There's all these things that you have to worry about on training runs, and then going to a race is just like a celebration. So that's what really sort of hooked me on it, is just this exciting energy. And so it's not like greyhound racing in that sense. Like, nobody's making any money off dog sledding. They're only doing it because they love it and they want to spend, honestly, all their money and time with huskies.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can imagine that it has to be a super time and energy intensive thing. Like, obviously the race is just one event, but like when you were describing this morning, just, you know, everything with all the dogs, that this must be like a lifestyle.
Oh God, absolutely. I mean, and I haven't even done dog care yet today. probably when I get off the phone, I'm going to go out and we have some chest freezers in the barn and we get donations of meat from the taxidermist. He puts aside meat that would be discarded, and you know, we pick it up. And so you never know what's going to be in the bag. It's actually really gross, but I'll go out and like hold my breath and dump out a bag and see what's in there. And then I chop it up with an axe so that every dog gets a big chunk. And then I'll go around and give everyone food, give them more water, scoop all the poop. You know, they run loose and they can play with each other during what I call recess. Usually not when people are coming home from work, because I want them to be quiet at that point. But I always spend at least a couple minutes, you know, playing with each dog individually and patting them down and making sure, you know, their health is really good. They don't have any sore spots, anything like that. So that takes a couple hours alone, and that's just basic, like, keeping the dogs alive and happy. If I'm doing training runs, that could add anywhere from 3 to 8 hours to that routine.
I mean, first, I'm stuck on the visual of you chopping mystery taxidermied meat with an axe.
It's not a mystery once you dump out the bag.
Oh, my God.
But it's like, I don't know. I don't want to gross out anyone.
No,
but you can tell what it is.
Yeah, so. No. It just, yeah, that's something that you do that is definitely not what everyone is doing, you know, in their day. So you said training runs can add 3 to 8 hours. So, like, what is training? I'm curious about what training's like, and also, like, what an actual race is like, the kind of, like, nitty-gritty details of actually what happens.
Yeah, so training, and there's different kinds of dog sledding. Just to back up even more, there's, like, sprint dog sledding, where people use, you know, like really houndy dogs. They almost use greyhounds or greyhound mutts, and they'll take like 4 dogs for 4 miles at like something insane, like 30 miles an hour. I mean, they look like ski jumpers in their outfits and their helmets, and that's really different from what I do. Like, it's amazing to watch. But I'm a long distance musher. So instead of going 30 miles per hour for 4, 6, or 10 miles, I will go 8 to 12 miles per hour for 300 miles. So it's a really different sport, even though they're both dog sledding.
That makes sense, yeah.
So for a training run, I have a year after I got my first six dogs, I heard from a musher who was unable to care for his dogs anymore. You know, really loved them, but couldn't care for them. And he was looking for someone who could take over the 15 dogs he had. And so I ended up doing that. And the dogs are a whole range of ages. The oldest was 12 and the youngest were 2. You know, one of them's totally blind. Like, it's really a pretty diverse group, and they're lovely. So that was when I really got, you know, at that point I was a lifestyle musher when I was caring for 21 dogs every day. And right now we have puppies, and also some of those dogs we adopted have retired. So, you know, we kind of have a waiting list for people who want a retired sled dog as a pet. And, you know, we make sure it's a home we know, and then, you know, the dog can retire to that home and get really spoiled. I mean, our friend, he's our friend now, but a friend bought a monastery and is turning it into an artist residency. And it's literally a castle. It's like an hour from here. And he took in 2 dogs who are 10 and 12 and bought them each their own couch and like literally puts down a tablecloth for them when they eat. It's ridiculous. It's so cute. But so if I go out on a training run, first I'll make sure they all have like a little snack, but not a lot. It's like humans. You don't want to exercise right after you have a big meal. I put a harness on each one. They all have their own harness that fits them. Depending on the conditions, I may put booties on all of their feet or on some of their feet. And that protects if they're going on certain types of gravel that are sharp, or if the snow is a certain consistency where it can get like stuck in little balls between their pads and irritate their feet, that's when I'll use the booties. And if I don't use booties, then I put wax on all their feet before they go, which just conditions them and keeps them healthy. And so I'll hook up the dogs anywhere from, you know, if I just want to like check out the trail and make sure, you know, a storm didn't knock trees down and I'm expecting to get off a lot, it might be 4 dogs. But usually I actually have a 4-wheeler that doesn't work. It only works in neutral. And I can hook up 20 dogs to the front of it. And, you know, they just pull it over anything. They love it. So that's what it looks like around now. It would be like first thing in the morning, frost on the grass, hooking the dogs up to the 4-wheeler. It has a headlight, which is really nice, even though the engine doesn't run. Because otherwise, I'm just like fiddling with headlamps and flashlights and all sorts of things. And then we'll go out early in the season. We usually stop by rivers and stuff, and they drink along the way when it's warm. When it gets colder, they like bite snow as they go along, so it's not as important. And, you know, we go for however long. For, you know, half an hour would be a really short, fast run, and we get up to probably 3 to 4 hours is a really typical training run by midwinter. And the goal is always to end before they're tired out. You know, it's like a kid. You want to end while they're still having fun. If I ever misjudge or there's some sort of storm or problem, then I might camp out even overnight. I might just, you know, I always have some survival gear with me. You know, light a fire. The dogs dig themselves little igloos and I'll wait it out with them.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, is what do you bring with you? Like, what kind of supplies do you have?
I'm wearing my parka, right? Like a lot of clothing, and I have stuff on the sled. And I have to carry more in the winter than I do in the fall because you're out in the snow. It's just sort of higher. There's more things that can go wrong and you're going farther. But I will always bring lots of food inside my parka. You know, like a first aid kit and a power bar and like a bottle of water on the inside pocket so it doesn't freeze, fire starters. All those are on my parka because if something goes wrong, if the if I fall off the sled, if the dogs chase a deer and somehow I get knocked off, they will leave without me. And I will be out there, you know, 30 miles in deep snow with no one knowing where I am. And they'll just run home.
Has that ever happened?
It has happened to me once in 10 years. And the way it happened, you know, the number one rule is you never let go of the sled. So the number one rule once you're out there. So plenty of times the sled has tipped over and I'll get dragged for several minutes, you know, holding on my belly before I can climb back on. And that's not that big of a deal because you're on snow. It doesn't really hurt. But once, I have no idea how it happened, but the handle of the sled broke off, just came right off. I think it must have dry rotted over the summer or something. And, you know, suddenly I was there on my butt on the trail holding the handle as tight as I could. And then the sled without the handle and all the dogs, you know, continued on without me. And it wasn't a big deal. They came back home. I know that other times, they passed like several snowmobilers along the way because I started walking after them. And then I ran into snowmobilers who were like, are you supposed to be with like all the dogs that don't have a person with them? But it wasn't a big deal. I was on a normal training run, but you know, you don't want that to happen.
No, I mean, I definitely don't want that. Anything. I don't even want the thing to happen that you described about getting dragged on your belly behind the sled. Oh my gosh.
Well, yeah. So then in the winter inside my sled bag, I'll have an Arctic sleeping bag. I will have, food for all the dogs, snacks, a more intensive first aid kit, usually a ski pole, and I'll use the ski pole for like ski poling, like pushing along, as if I were on cross country skis. And that just, you know, keeps me warm and gives the dogs a little boost. An axe. I carry an axe always, a folding saw. That might be most of it.
Is that the same type of gear that you would take during a race?
Pretty much. Extra booties, extra, you know, extra headlamp. Every race has required gear. So they'll come out and they'll check and they'll be like, okay, do you have snowshoes? Do you have a stove? Do you have, you know, enough booties for every dog to have two extra pair? Do you have... And it'll depend, you know, a short race, it might be like, hey, do you have water? And it's almost sort of like they know you're not going to need it. But when I've been in really long distance races, you know, over anything more than a day, anything where you're out sort of overnight and into the next day, and it's a real long distance camping trip with your dogs, I mean, your sled is full.
So, okay, so first question, what's the longest race that you've done?
The longest race I've done is 240 miles.
Oh my God. Okay. So, I mean, any knowledge of long distance things is just in the running world, right? Like with ultra marathons and that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you hear of people doing 100 milers and that they basically are running all night. Like, is that this kind of thing where you're going in the dark too? Or do you really like make it a point to camp by a certain time? Or how is that different?
Usually there's checkpoints along the way. So every 40 to 70 miles, there will be a place with like a field, and you can send ahead like a bag of stuff. So I might have a bag that has like an extra sleeping bag because the other thing is you don't actually want to unpack your sled. So you have all this stuff for emergencies, but like it's just going to take time and energy that you don't have to actually unpack it and pack it again. So I'll send like a sleeping bag ahead and lots of good dog food and extra clothes. And so then you can stop at a checkpoint or you can not stop, you know, anywhere from 5 minutes. You just initial that you came through. Or, you know, there's always veterinarians there. sometimes there's a place you can go inside, but definitely not always. Sometimes there's water, but definitely not always. In which case you have to melt snow or, you know, chop open river ice or something. And yeah, so that's just a place where mushers gather along the way. So typically you'd stop at the checkpoint and not along the trail unless there was a problem.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, and obviously, like I said, like my entire frame of reference for any of this is going to be running related, which I know is not the same, but like I'm thinking of like as a runner, I mean, the longest race that I've done is a marathon, right? So like not even that, but you know,
that's really long.
The times when it's mentally hard, like, so for you specifically in the role that you play in this, what would you say are the biggest challenges, or are there low points, or like, what does that look like kind of mentally, physically for you?
It is much harder on the mushers than the dogs. And the reason for that is that whenever you stop, you spend all your time taking care of the dogs. So if I, you know, if we run 50 miles, which is sort of a nice medium long run, and then we get to a checkpoint and we're there for 6 hours, I'm going to spend, you know, the first thing I do is there's usually a bale of hay for each team. So I'll take my bale of hay and I'll make a little like dog bed made of hay for every dog so they can curl up and be warm. And then I'll start preparing their food. I'll be chopping. I'll be cooking things in the stove, you know, like a Primus type stove. I will go through and inspect every one of my dog's feet, usually like while they're sleeping. They just sort of hold it out while they're snoring. I will repair anything on the sled. Then I wake up, or, you know, then when they're starting to wake up, by that time it's been several hours and it's time for like another meal that I'm prepared. And like maybe one of them seems a little stiff, who's a little older, and I'll give that dog a massage. So like all this rest time, the dogs just sleep straight through. That's my goal. And the mushers, you know, moving around, doing things for the dogs. So it's funny, at the end of a race, you'll see like the dogs come in and they're just like gleaming, and the mushers come in and they have aged 10 years in 3 days. And obviously the dogs are the athletes, right? They're the ones who are pulling. They're the ones with the incredible endurance. I often think of myself as like the coach of a team, more than an athlete myself. But it's also, it can be pretty physical. I mean, you're running up every hill. You might, if it's deep snow, you might just be like tramping down the trail ahead of them for miles. And you just have to be upright and physical for, you know, 24 hours at a stretch. So it takes its toll on me too, but they're the impressive ones and I'm sort of their, you know, I tag along and I'm slower than them.
Have you ever had, whether in a race or a long training run, that something that sticks out for you as a real mental, like, low point?
My last big race I was in this spring, I was, like, not doing super well in the race. I was, like, toward the back, which was fine. My goal was to get some young dogs through. But I hadn't seen anyone in hours and hours and hours. I was 180 miles in, and I came around a corner at 2 a.m, and there was a woman lying on the trail and a dog team right there. And it turns out that she was pretty seriously hypothermic and had been there for hours and had, you know, sometimes you have like an emergency beacon that you can press that they put on your sled. She had pressed it and it didn't work. So I ended up, you know, of course I tied down my dogs and I was talking to her and putting my sleeping bag around her and, you know, trying to do what I could to keep her awake and warm her up and sort of like, I started like force feeding her a Kit Kat bar because your body needs so many calories when you're out there. And she sort of was coming in and out of responsiveness. And this was a woman I know through the network. You know, I hadn't hung out with her personally, but you know, we'd always been friendly at races. And it took like 4 hours for emergency rescuers to get out there. So that was really scary. And she ended up being fine. And actually, she had a chronic illness, which she talks publicly about. And one of her sled dogs was a service dog, which she managed to sort of whisper to me. So when the EMTs came, I was able to say, no, you have to bring this dog. And she sent me a picture afterwards of her lying in the hospital bed with a husky still in its harness. So that was really scary, but everyone was okay in the end.
Yeah, I feel, I mean, obviously that's like the outer edge, right? Like, of course, like scary things can happen. I feel like, I mean, obviously I'm just projecting, but I can't imagine just like being alone for so long in the cold. Like that sounds, I don't know, it sounds tough.
Yeah, and it's, there's not a lot of margin for error when you're out there. I mean, it's silly, but I was in a race, I was in the starting chute, which is like there's crowds and they wave at you going by and you run through the middle of them on your way out to the trail. And I was waving and I dropped my mitten. And that was like a 6 hour race. It wasn't particularly long, but it was 10 PM at night. So I was going to be running through the night and it was 20 below and I didn't have one of my mittens. And that's a really big deal. Like you can't turn around. Dog teams only go in one direction.
Right, right.
So I ended up, you know, it was fine, and I'm good at the cold. You know, I'm not perfect, but I think of cold as a skill that you can sort of learn how to handle and be more comfortable in. But I was pretty chilly by the time I crossed the finish line.
Yeah. Okay. So cold is a skill that I need to learn, right? Like going off what you just said. So I moved up. I mean, obviously this is not like Arctic, right? But I moved to Bend, Oregon, almost 2 years ago. It's almost 2 years. And the thing that I really can't wrap my head around yet is the winter and just like, it's so cold. I mean, I lived in Southern California for a long time and just, I don't know. So like, tell me about if they're basically, what do I need to do to not be such a baby in the cold?
You have to wear a lot of clothes and they have to be the right clothes. You know, just don't wear, you're not going to wear like your normal fall outfit and put a wool coat over it and like be ready to be out in the cold. And I don't know, maybe you are because you're going to work and you don't want to look like a, you know, Yeti. But if you want to be out for longer, you know, I usually have, by the time I'm done putting on my shoes, if it's really cold, my feet are twice as long as my actual feet. Like my foot surface, because there's like shoes on top of shoes on top of shoes, is twice as long as my feet are. And so then I'll wear, you know, two pair of wool long underwear. I just got some Canada Goose gear. Like I got their Antarctic parka and a pair of bibs. And I've always been old school. Like I learned in Norway, like, no, you don't need anything high tech. You just wear like 15 layers of wool. And I've always been like pretty vehement about that. And then a sponsor was able to get this Canada Goose gear for me. And like, man, that makes things way more comfortable.
Yeah, it works. Yeah, that makes sense.
It definitely works. Like, I'm a convert. There's no way I'd be able to buy a $1,200 parka on my own, but it's a good parka.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so for $1,200. So speaking about cold and stuff in general, when we were emailing beforehand about, hey, things to talk about, you know, when you were saying life with sled dogs and you said life in the Arctic, tell me about life in the Arctic. I mean, again, I have no frame of reference, but I would love to hear about it.
Well, the place I have ended up living on and off in the Arctic is, it's a place I sort of ended up by accident. Maybe 5 years ago, It's near where the folk school was, which was also Arctic. But it's this former seal hunting village about 200 miles above the Arctic Circle, near Tromsø, if anyone knows Norway. And there's only 40 people, and most of them are sort of aging bachelors. And they have this one shop. So I sort of took up residence in the shop. I was writing about this place. I was writing about the Arctic. I was writing about dog sledding. I was writing about, like, fear and being a woman in those environments. And I just sort of moved into the shop and would just, like, listen to people's stories all day. And, you know, then, like, reindeer would get stuck on someone's roof and we'd all be like, ah, the reindeer, and we'd go try to get them out. And it's actually, it's not that much colder than northern Wisconsin, but it is dark. It is light for months on end. And then in the winter, the sun goes down in November and it doesn't rise for like 70 days. Just, you don't see the sun for 70 days. And I actually found, one time I was there for the whole 70 days. Other times I've sort of come and gone, you know, but not been there that entire time. But I was like, oh, I'm handling this so well. People get depressed and, you know, seasonal, what's it called? Sad seasonal affective
disorder.
Seasonal
affective disorder, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, no, like, I was so self-righteous. I was like, the reason people get sad is because they're just sitting inside. They're not outside, like, being in the fresh air. And it doesn't matter how dark it is. If you're in the fresh air for hours a day, like, you'll feel good. And I was, like, very, very self-righteous about all this. And there was, like, you know, half an hour to an hour of twilight around 1 p.m. And that was the only time you could sort of see enough to get around without a headlamp. And then there'd be northern lights and they'd be like, they were mostly green up there. We didn't see a lot of colors. But it would just sort of cast everything green. Like the snow and the mountains would all just sort of look like, you know, you were looking through a scummy fishbowl at them or something. I mean, it just would be like shifting and sort of magical. This is actually the area that the Disney movie Frozen was based off.
Oh, funny. Okay.
It's like that exact region. And then the sun rose and it was like February and I was shoveling snow in the dog yard and I like felt it in my body before I saw it. Like suddenly it was like my skin went hard or something or like electricity. And this sliver of the sun rose over the fjord. And I mean, my response was chemical. Like there's not, I haven't really done drugs, but it's sort of how I imagine they would be. Like I was so elated, but irrationally so. Like I was sort of observing my body like become thrilled and electrified by this, like way more than anything I've ever felt in my life. And I just sort of sat there and then, you know, a minute or two later, the little sliver of sun sank back down and I was just stunned. I just couldn't move for like an hour. And, you know, the next day it happened again. And at some point I became more used to it, but it was chemical. I mean, I had to really eat my words. But I have my diary from that year and I wrote, like a full month after the sun had started coming up again, I wrote in my diary, and I firmly believed this would be true for the rest of my life. Like, I just was totally convinced. I wrote, I'm glad that now for the rest of my life, I'll never be able to be unhappy when the sun is up. And I, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I'll remember to appreciate it. It was like, you know, my body just would be like high off this, off the UV rays.
That's so crazy. I mean, I can't imagine it being dark for 70 days.
It, you know, what happens is you lose track of day and night.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine.
It sort of feels like a really long day where you're taking naps and, you know, people sleep a lot more and light a lot of candles. But it's this weird, almost like rolling through the darkness. Like time feels different. You know, you're governed less by light than by like your watch, and you realize how arbitrary that is.
I mean, completely, completely. So, I mean, by all accounts, I feel like this is could be a hard place to live. So I'm curious, what about it attracts you? Like, why do you keep going back? Or like, what is it about that appeals to you?
I mean, that's something I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out, and it's, I don't know if I can give an easy answer. I think a lot of my book was written because I was trying to understand this complicated draw I felt to the North. Welcome to the goddamn ice cube, which, like, obviously a goddamn ice cube isn't a good thing, but, and yet I kept coming back. And for me, you know, growing up as a young woman, I really felt like, you know, like somehow I could prove my courage. If I could prove my courage to myself, then I knew I'd be okay. If I could live in these places when I was a teenage girl that were at times almost totally male, you know, I'd be the only girl living in a tent city with like 40 men on snow. And that was terrifying and that was dangerous. And yet I kept thinking, you know, I will be able to win this. I'll be able to like pass this like a class, you know, like, and I'll realize I reached that step. And that feeling has faded for me. I no longer feel like I'm trying to prove anything. It's just a place that I feel a lot of joy. But it was complicated at first. I think it was almost a kind of counter phobia where I was, you know, revisiting a place that had scared and sometimes harmed me.
So, yeah, I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit. I mean, on one hand, you know, being a woman in the wilderness, you know, whatever you want to say about that. But, you know, I think there's that. But then there's also what you just spoke about of being sometimes the only woman in, you know, either a male-dominated sport, city, situation. Like, what? I don't know. If there's something in there that you want to talk about, I would love that.
Yeah, well, I ended up experiencing a fair amount of sexual violence from a sort of parental figure up there, not one of my parents. And you know, that fucks you up. And I ended up, I mean, I was, you know, I became really afraid of men when I was a teenager, but I felt like I could learn to like surf the waves of this ocean that had pulled me under. Like I could make it work. I could like be around men until I wasn't frightened anymore. I could be like a man. I could, you know, I dressed in clothes that, you know, totally covered my body. I wore male clothes from the thrift store so that people would take me seriously. I really, really, really was trying to, I think, come to grips with what had happened in a way that felt like I was becoming more myself instead of less of myself. And I mean, the thing about the wilderness, the thing about cold, and you know, this isn't why I went up there, but I think it's real, is that I was scared for my body, but I wanted to be, you know, I loved wilderness. I loved dogs. But I was so anxious about, you know, people being close to my body, people looking at me. And the thing about cold is that nobody thinks of anyone else's body. You're wearing like every item of clothing you have on. And, you know, everyone is just concerned with their own toes. They're not concerned with yours. And it's not that that was what I wanted or was seeking out so much as that I think that that allowed me to relax in a way that I wasn't able to in other situations, and sort of feel freer and have that extra courage to do things in the actual wilderness. And then the thing about the wilderness is there's no people. And you know, the people are there, they're either setting out to harm you, right, which is rare. It's really rare. Or you're on the same team. If you're out in the wilderness and you come across someone, you're like teammates out there. And it's all about, dog sledding is all about problem solving. Like, so many things go wrong. And I used to just dream of having one dog sled run where nothing would go wrong. Like, the dogs wouldn't get tangled. We wouldn't chase a deer. We wouldn't get, like, stuck in a river. Like, all these things. I was like, oh, my gosh, I wouldn't get dragged behind the sled. Everything, every run, something went wrong. And I was thinking about that lately, and I realized, oh, you know, I finally did it, because I can't think of things that went wrong on the last couple runs. And then I thought a little harder and I realized, no, you know, the same things are still happening, but I no longer think of them as problems. It's just like, oh, we're in a river, time to get out, you know. Oh, there's an animal. Well, we'll ride it out and, you know, move the dogs. And, oh, they're tangled. Like, oh, we just untangle them. Like, it's not, it's just part of life. It's not, it's no longer a problem.
Yeah. I mean, that is a perspective and a mindset that I'm very interested in. I remember a couple seasons ago, I had my friend Lauren Fleshman on the show, who's a runner, and we were talking about the relationship with pain and just like the process of training. And she was saying something about how like she used to think that she was training like to not feel pain in races or anything like that. But then it was the perspective switch of realizing like you're actually training so that you'll just be able to handle it when it happens. And I hear a lot of that in what you're saying too.
Yeah, that seems really similar. Not about pain per se, but about, I think, about fear.
Yeah, so what do I want to ask? This like situation that you're describing, you know, being in the Arctic and, you know, that being a place to confront fears, what do you think it is or was about you that allowed you to thrive in a situation where maybe other people wouldn't?
I think I'm pretty deep into my own head. And I don't know. I mean, honestly, almost everyone I know who has tried dog sledding has gotten hooked. So I don't know if I'm so different in that regard. I don't know. I think I was able to relax there, and I'm not an adrenaline seeker. I mean, I don't actually like high speeds or sort of scary, dangerous things. I'm much better with like slow motion emergencies than high speed emergencies. Like, oh, someone has hypothermia. Like, okay, I can think this through and I'm going to deal with it. But like, oh my gosh, we're like about to crash into this, go off a cliff. Like, then I'm just like, I want to throw out my hands and be like, okay, you know, I guess I'm dying now. Goodbye, world. I do not like high speed problems. And I don't know what it is. I think that I thrive well being solitary. I like the physical work. I like being outside. My body handles cold well, which is not negligible. You know, being around dogs, I will never get tired of being around dogs and building relationships with them. And I also, the other thing now is that I spend so much time in front of a computer screen because that's my work, right? Like, I'm writing for magazines or I'm editing or I'm, you know, just doing sort of building a career within the literary world. And I'm just always staring at a screen when I'm at my desk. And I'm in my head, like nothing physical is happening. I'm thinking, I'm obsessing over word choice, right? And then I go outside and I'm not in my head at all. And it works really well for me as a balance.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I mean, it seems like in a couple of things that you've said, this idea of fear has come up. Whether that was, you know, when you were saying feeling afraid of men, you know, what would you say, I guess, in addition to that, are other really tangible fears that you have had to face?
Well, when you write a memoir, suddenly you have to tell people things that you never thought you'd have to tell them. You know, I ended up talking to my parents about ways I'd been angry at them since I was 16. It's personal and you can't. So that was scary, right? I was afraid of what people would think. And actually, I've only had good responses, which is miraculous. I would say I'm really scared of my dogs getting hurt, of losing my dogs. And I lost two dogs this year. And that, I mean, it's the hardest thing, you know. And they're healthy. They're healthy until they're not. I mean, this breed really tends to, like, compensate and compensate and compensate. So, you know, I had my lead dog who was only 5 years old, and one day his face was a little swollen, and I brought him to the vet, and the vet was like, oh, it looks like, you know, maybe he got an infection in his gums from eating something sharp. Put him on antibiotics. Within 2 weeks, he was blind and deaf and dying of lymphoma.
Wow.
So, and I've heard that story again and again, and I've seen it happen. Like, they're very healthy dogs, but because they're sort of so hardy, they will be, like, strong and fine and healthy until suddenly whatever it is just, like, hits a tipping point, and you know, their body can't do it anymore, and suddenly you see all those symptoms really fast. If you're hearing toenails right now, it's because I think Flame is like, why are you talking about sick dogs? She's coming over to me. Honey, you're in the way. And that is, I mean, that you grieve. That is the hardest thing. It's not like a fear that I can face. It's, you know, a deep sorrow that comes with loving this many animals.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the emotional depth. That's part of what it, you know, part of this lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You mentioned moving to your fiance's farm land. Mm-hmm. How'd you two meet?
We met in Iowa at grad school, and we were in the same cohort. So we started the same day, and all four of our classes were the same. And there were only 11 people starting that year. And so I had just walked across Oregon. I walked the coast of Oregon from Washington to California that summer. And he had just ridden his horse across the Dakotas and, like, rode his horse to school and had been working as a cowboy. And we were just like, this is pretty good. Like, this is a pretty good combination.
And what is his interest in the Arctic and or dog sledding?
Well, he's a horse guy. So, like, the house we live in now, we have this beautiful log house. He built it out of logs that he pulled out of the forest with a team of draft horses. So, like, he's like a caricature of, like, the most lumber sexual cowboy ever. I mean, it's like a joke. But he was in the military for 8 years and did a lot of, like, cold weather survival training. He would teach cold weather survival.
So he needs to teach me how to love the winter. I got it. Okay.
Well, that was one of the things we bonded over is, you know, it'd be cold and we'd be like, let's go outside. Let's go play in it. And so he had his horse who we named Untitled. And I didn't have dogs yet, but he took to it. He was really encouraging. He was like, hey, you know, that's not my thing, but if you get dogs, I'll be part of the team and I'll, you know, and he'd be up late at 2 a.m. reading obscure articles by mushers from 50 years ago. And he'd, like, nudge me and be like, hey, like, it says if we, you know, put this, I don't even know. He geeks out on it in a way I don't geek out. Like, okay, if we do this, like, very specific schedule, or, hey, it looks like if we put olive oil on their noses. I mean, that's not true, but, like, it's things like that. And so he's taken to it because he has this experience with animals and cold, and he's physically braver than I am. Like, he'll be like, hey, I'll jump on a 10-dog team going down a mountain, and I'll be like, maybe I, you know, maybe I'm going to do 5 dogs and do it twice. And so he's really gifted, and it became something we do together.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, and I would imagine that's important too, given, like you said, it's not something that you just do for a half hour or an hour in a day. This is like so much of your life.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about like dog sledding divorces, because it's just, you know, if one person has 5 or 10 or 40 dogs and the other person isn't into it, you have to be. I mean, he is allergic to dogs. Which is sort of the one thing. So I'm really careful. And, you know, when the dogs come in the house, they're only in sort of like my space, like my office, and they don't go near the couch or anywhere like that. And I always wash my hands after petting them and stuff.
Nothing like raising 11 puppies when you're allergic to dogs.
Oh my God. He was in Alaska all summer, so I raised the puppies on my own.
So, okay. Oh, well, that adds a whole other layer of complications, right? So tell me what you are training for right now.
I'm working to qualify for the Iditarod. And the Iditarod is an 1,100-mile race across Alaska every March. And, way, way, way more people have like summited Mount Everest than completed the Iditarod. It's, you know, it bills itself as the last great race on earth. There's a couple dog sled races of that length, but it's sort of the most commercial. You know, it's the one with the most press. And it's, it's almost like qualifying for like the national championships or the Olympics. Sorry, this dog, Flame, you're being really annoying. She just wants all my attention all the time. It takes years. It takes years to qualify. You have to do 700 miles of qualifying races. And like before that, you have to qualify for the qualifying races. And it just takes a long time. So I have done one of my 3 official qualifiers. And then the other 2 I can do over the course of 1 season. And the season after that, knock on wood, I'd be qualified. But it's funny. It's kind of creepy because this one was, 200 miles and it was in a snowstorm and, you're being evaluated like a team. If you sign up, anyone can enter the race, right? I mean, not anyone, but there were only 2 people in the race who were using it as an Iditarod qualifier. And so we'd be like at a checkpoint at 2 a.m. in a blizzard and like, 5 men with clipboards would be staring at me like, knock over my stove at 2 a.m. Like they would just stand there with clipboards and you get evaluated for things like, normal things like dog care and sportsmanship, ability to tolerate cold, ability to handle dogs in heat, ability to take care of your dog's feet. Whether you're crabby or not to other mushers, like it's this ridiculous report card. And then you get like a written evaluation from everyone. And if you do well enough, then they write a letter to the Iditarod, saying that they want to nominate you. So I have one of those down that I did successfully. And it's the only one I've attempted, so I'll do 2 more next season.
So why are the standards so high?
I got a pretty big score in everything except for fire building, which is my weakness. I need to practice. Because it's really dangerous, and it's really high. I mean, they don't want anyone who they don't think can successfully finish it.
That makes sense.
It's, it's like, is it hard to get into the Tour de France? Like, you can't just be like, hey, I ride a bicycle.
Right.
You have to, you know, sort of get there first.
So in addition to fire building, what are some other either skills that you would want to gain or improve on? Or like, basically, who do you have to become, like, within yourself? What do you think needs to happen in order to be able to successfully do this race?
I think the biggest thing, part of the reason that I had puppies this summer is that a lot of the dogs that I got originally are sort of aging out. I mean, they're great and they run with the puppies and we're still running them, but like maybe they're 7 or 8 this year, which means that if I'm qualified for the Iditarod in 2 or 3 years, they'll be 10 and 11, which like maybe they can do it, but maybe they're also getting arthritis. I certainly know of 11-year-old dogs who have run 1,000 miles well and done well. And I also know of some who are kind of like, you know what? It's time for me to like get a couch. So these puppies are sort of going to be my racing team. And so I think the biggest thing, it's the first time I've ever had my own puppies and I just want to raise them right. You know, I want to train them to be really solid and forward oriented and find their way around obstacles and love what they do. And, some of that will be easy and some of that will be harder, but it's really different. It's really different to have your own dogs versus running someone else's. And I just imagine that having puppies that you've sort of caught when they were born, it's an even deeper bond. The dogs that I feel I have the closest relationship with are the ones that I got when they were younger. And we just sort of grew together. Whereas the older ones, it's more like, oh, I can learn from their experience. And they've got it down and they're sort of like, you know, they have their network already.
Mm-hmm. That totally makes
sense. It's going to be really exciting.
Yeah. So I'm always curious when someone has a really big long-term goal, because you said, hey, if you're qualified in 2 or 3 years, like how you maintain the balance of like, you have this big goal, you're really excited about it, but it has such a long timeline. I don't know, like mentally, what helps you to stay focused on something that's still so far away?
It doesn't seem very far away. I think that it's, you know, I always thought, okay, I'm going to do longer races and bigger challenges with my dogs, but only if it's fun, right? Like, I'm not actually interested in, like, being uncomfortable to be uncomfortable anymore. At some point, maybe I was. But what I found is that the more we do together, the longer we travel together, the more fun it gets. It just sort of magnifies, and you're exhausted, and you haven't slept in 3 days, and your headlamp's out of batteries, but it's still just sort of feels right to me to be around the clock on the trail with your dogs. The transition from being alone with them to not being alone with them is always jarring. Like when you finish a long run or a race, or if there's people around and you go from this sort of meditative but also very intense, demanding state of being out in the woods with them, and suddenly it's like, oh, maybe like your handler walks up and they start feeding, and like there's all these complicated things, and I sort of love pushing, extending that time when it's just me and them.
Yeah, which I mean, in training for an 1100 mile race, I assume that you will have plenty of that time.
yeah, I mean, and I'm still learning so much. I'm just moving up into long distance. From mid distance, which is like, you know, 20 to 80 miles. And so I'm just learning all the time from it. So it's new, you know. I don't know if I'm going to want to do the Iditarod year after year after year and be sort of a career distance racer in the way that, a lot of really great mushers are. But right now I love just sort of always learning and always trying new things.
Yeah. I mean, definitely that makes sense. Also, when it's something that's new, that there's so many opportunities, it's like such a fertile ground for growing and learning because you have to.
For sure. For sure. And it's just, dog sledding is one of the only sports where women and men compete together. There's only 3 sports that are like that on the professional level. And I've like met other So there's way more men than women, but I've like gotten to know other female mushers, and you know, I have, having my own dogs, I'm able to sort of befriend mushers in a different way, where instead of like being a handler, it's like, okay, we're all figuring out, what are we going to do this winter? What are we going to do if we have a warm spell in January throughout the Midwest, and then all our frozen meat thaws? You know, all these things, there's really a communal effort for something that's so spread out.
Mm-hmm. So your book, I want to talk about your book. Obviously, you know, having gone to an MFA program doing this, it's not like you just randomly decided one day, hey, maybe I'm going to try my hand at, you know, writing a book. but I'm curious about your writing process. Like, once you decided to do this, what did the process of writing this book look like?
I sold the book 4 years before it came out. So it came out in July, and it's done really well. It's gotten a lot of like good national press, good reviews. So I'm really excited about that. I've been hearing from readers I don't even know, which is sort of mind-boggling to me. I'm like, you're not my friend. Like, why did you feel compelled to pick this up if you're not doing me a favor? But like, they do, and I'm grateful. But I sold it 4 years ago on proposal. I sent out a proposal through my agent, and she sent it out to publishers. And then I was just sort of working on it, going back and forth to Norway, you know, editing and revising and working with my editor. And I'd write in the morning, and then I would do dogs in the afternoon and evening. And it's been weird. It was weird once it sort of was out of my hands. I mean, my life is fairly split between being very intensely about writing and very intensely about sled dogs. And I think luckily I was able to, you know, turn my focus just a little bit more to the dogs, and it didn't feel empty to me.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and also, like, having worked on something for 4 years, talk about long-term goals, right? Like, it's not like this is a new thing
for
you. Yeah. So, do you have any, I don't know if tips or advice is the right word, but thoughts, anything for either new writers or struggling writers or anyone who's interested in writing their own memoir? Like, anything from your own experience that you would share?
For sure. I think, and this is, I haven't heard this from other places, really, but I feel pretty strongly about it. I think that when you don't want to write, people talk about overcoming writer's block and how to get past that. And I think when you don't want to write, you shouldn't write. I mean, writing is communication, and, you know, just trust that your skill is there. It'll be there when you need it. But like, we don't talk just to have talked for an hour a day, like saying nothing. Like, writing is communication, and you'll want to write when something is gelled in your head and you're ready to communicate it. So my life is so cyclical, you know. I have December through March is so intensely sled dogs. I hardly look at a word at all. You know, and then I have months where I'm writing, you know, a year's worth of writing in 3 months. And so I often have times where I'll go a couple months without writing at all. And my artist friends get really stressed about things like that. Like, oh my gosh, like, I'm not writing. What does that mean? But they always, you know, they always want to eventually. Something comes and something gels. And I think that living your life is a really important part of writing. It's not a distraction from it. And just trust. Don't worry if you don't feel like writing. Don't worry about writer's block. If you're thoughtful, if you're introspective and you're working on self-awareness, which is not always pleasant, if you're experiencing the world, all of these things are going to they're going to become something at some point, and then you'll be able to write it. But it'll be in its own time.
Yeah, I personally am very grateful for and love what you just shared, because I think the opposite is what we hear so much, right? Like, if you're a real writer, you have to write every day, or like doing something even when you're not in the mood to do it. And I mean, perhaps success is somewhere in the middle of those two, right? Like, if you're not writing out of fear or perfectionism and that just builds and builds, like, probably that's not the best either. At some point, maybe you have to sit down when you're not in the mood to do it. But
well, it's not always fun, right? Well, it's not always enjoyable. But if you have nothing to write, then probably you shouldn't be writing.
Well, I mean, but yeah, I think you're hitting on like a small but powerful distinction. Like there's a difference between genuinely not having anything to say and mm-hmm. having something to say, but being afraid to do it, right? The difference between like fear yes. and the actual like seasons of creation. Like, I mean, this comes up on the podcast all the time, just that I feel like you do that. I mean, we're not robots. You can't, I mean, most people, I think, don't operate trying to crank out, okay, well, you have to write 2,000 words a day every day or, you know, whatever, like the Stephen King advice, you know? And
yeah,
like we're just using writing as an example, but it's the same for all kinds of things. Like there's periods of time where I just feel like I'm more in hibernation. And then there's periods of time that are huge outputs or, and obviously everyone's different. And I think it's like the process of getting to know your own rhythms and not like there isn't one way to be a writer.
Yeah, and everything in nature is cyclical. Relationships are cyclical. Things are seasonal, and it'll just come back around. I mean, I work with one thing I do in addition to just writing for publication is I work with private clients who are working on a big project. So someone will say, okay, I want to work on this memoir. I'm retired, and I will talk to them on the phone once a week and look over drafts and just sort of be like a developmental editor through it. And so it's really interesting. I love teaching. And it's interesting to see sort of the same problems come up for people again and again and again, where, before they even start writing, they're worried about what different readers are going to think. People will obsess over grammar or pronouns. And do you know how much I don't care about grammar? Like that's, most writers have a good handle on grammar, but like, that's not what makes work good. What makes work good is the content. And, I just like a lot of my work is helping people to sort of let go of their anxieties or put them aside just long enough to be able to, actually have the courage to do something. I often tell people write things that are only for yourself. Like I wrote my whole book pretending it was just going to be for me because otherwise I wouldn't have been brave enough to write it. Pretend this is just for you. I will give them homework that's really like, writing prompts that are things like, I will never admit that, and then have them make a list. And sort of whenever you're on this border between like saying the unsayable and speaking from a place of honesty and observation rather than the dominant narratives we see throughout the world, the stories we've heard again and again, I mean, that's when you're getting at something real. That's when the writing often comes on its own. It wants to be told, and when people hit that groove, it will come easily. But I've heard fiction writers say, and I'm not a fiction writer, I write nonfiction. I've heard them say that if you don't know how to continue a story, if you have writer's block, it's because you're trying to get the characters to do something that they wouldn't really want to do or they don't really want to do. And I think that on a more basic, or not a more basic level, but on the nonfiction side, if you're writing memoir, if you're writing journalism, if you're writing lyric essays, if you're, whatever you're doing, I think that people get stopped up when what they're writing isn't true on a really, really basic level, not emotionally true. If there's anything that you think you can get away with not admitting, not telling, like odds are you can't, and savvy readers will always know, and you have to negotiate that.
So you mentioned giving people writing prompts or exercises. Are there any that come to mind? I know that you mentioned one that help to get like at what's true.
That's a good question. 'Cause I don't really do writing prompts for myself. I really like ones like I will never admit that. I really work with people one-on-one. So So I have a writer I'm working with right now. She's a lawyer, so she is like very argument. She's very good at arguing. I have to like step up and argue right back at her to convince her to do homework she doesn't want to do. And she was saying, look, she's like making this claim in her writing and she just feels like people will just be turned off by it. And they're right. She's so afraid that people are going to dismiss it immediately, that she can't even put it on the page. And then when she does, it's sort of defensive. And that really comes through. And she said to me, she was like, look, like I feel like what I'm trying to do is tell people, hey, look, there's a pink elephant in the sky over there. And their response is just going to be no. Like I'm just telling them something that they're so instantly going to believe isn't true that it's just, you know, there's a total block of communication. And I don't know how to start making that case. So I had her pause all the work she was working on. And for several weeks, I just had her write to me about the pink elephant in the sky. So I was like, look, I'm a reader and I need you to write me an essay that will convince me to at least take seriously the idea that there's a pink elephant in the sky. And she ended up, I mean, it's goofy, but it was a way of, you know, tackling the anticipated disbelief and developing those skills and finding out, oh, if I go about it this way, like that helps pull the reader in. Oh, maybe I feel like I can have this sort of camaraderie with them if I use this technique. She was able to find those techniques on something that felt really goofy. And then when she went back to, you know, her own work where something was really at stake, she hadn't been testing things out in that scary place. She'd been testing them out in a place of play, basically.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that totally makes sense. It makes sense too, the way you're characterizing that, like the heart of all of this is just being able to get to like the truest of the truth and say that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and if I think of the things that I have enjoyed the most as a reader, it's all stuff that operates in that space.
Well, it's so easy. And I was at my MFA, I was at, you know, I was sort of there in the middle of this big debate about like truth in nonfiction. And how much can you, you know, in your memoir, can you change the order of things if that makes it easier for the reader? Like conflating characters. If, can you say there was an apple on the table when there was a banana? Really sort of like extensive debate about that, which eventually I'm not that interested in. I mean, I sort of don't care if someone changes the fruit on the table in their writing. And I also, my priority in my writing is to do everything I can to be as factual as possible, but in an artful way. And what I became really interested in wasn't whether people were like fudging the truth or not, but why they wanted to. Mm. And I kept that in mind. I actually, the first draft of my book, I didn't feel the need to tell the truth. It was only for me. And I sort of like wrote the story as I like imagined it in my head and felt good about. And then what I did is I printed it all out and spread it out on my floor and went through. And every time I came across something that was even slightly not true, I would think, okay, why didn't I want to tell the truth there? Why did I think that this was too messy or too complicated or would reflect badly on me or someone else? Or like what fear of being boring, of being, you know, whatever it was made me change this. And then I would like push even harder to be honest. Like I would change it to whatever was factual, but I would go even deeper into that because those are moments, like whenever you're inclined to change the truth, that's a moment of really deep truth. And that's what's scary to get at. You know, so I want students or people I'm working with to go through and not fight the urge to like smooth over something or simplify it or, you know, slightly fib, but just notice those moments and figure out what that impulse is about. And that's where something really real and important is going on.
Yeah, because I mean, I think, I mean, I guess I could be wrong, but It doesn't really matter whether it's an apple or a banana, right? Whereas like this other stuff, like it's an interesting question. Like I'm always interested in like even truth, right? Like what is true? There's very few things that are like fundamentally like inarguable truth, but it's like, why are you telling the story, right? Because it's not like a transcript court reporting, right? And then they picked up the apple and then this, like that it doesn't matter if it's an apple or a banana. But that other instance where, like you said, you're trying not to speak about something that, I don't know, it's like the emotional truths and like the personal growth and like the interpersonal reactions or interactions, that's always what I'm more interested in than like whether like the walls were white or gray.
For sure. Although from my book, because it talks about sexual violence, it was really, really important for this project that it be unimpeachable. So I was like mm-hmm. calling people and being like, hey, what kind of sandwich did you eat 8 years ago? You know, that sort of thing, because I wasn't comfortable telling the story unless I could really, really stand behind it, all elements of it. But the most important honesty is emotional honesty. And that's how fiction works too, is it's, you know, fictional situations, but honest emotions. And, I lost my train of thought for a second. But I've really come around, I think, through doing this project to feeling like, okay, you know, ultimately if you're writing and you change it to a banana, I don't care. Like, I'm not offended as a reader. I don't feel deceived. Like, whatever. It's a fruit on a table. But I think that the more you keep the details totally true, the more opportunity you're giving the reader to figure things out that you haven't even figured out yet.
Interesting. Right? Yeah.
So what's been really cool is that because of specific details that are things like what kind of sandwich someone ate, I've had readers come forward with insights that I don't even know. Like, the truth is smarter than you are. And it's an apple on the table for a reason. And yeah, it'll be a good story still if you say it's a banana. But if you say it's an apple, like, there's some sort of reason for that. And it has to do with, like, you know, something basic like the seasons or something like, you know, you're in the middle of the city and you can only get good bananas but not good apples or whatever. And that just deepens it.
Yeah. What you just said, that the truth is smarter than you are. That's incredibly insightful. I'm like standing slow clap for that.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that for me, that's a compelling reason. I'm not super compelled by like, oh, you know, well, I feel deceived or, oh, like I should have artistic license. I just feel like, look, the work I'm interested in doing and the work I'm interested in reading is, you know, is really smart, right? And the truth is way smarter than you are. The story is smarter than you are. There are things going on in the story you have no idea about, even as you're writing it. But the more accurate your details are, the more accurate everything is, your timeline, your dialogue, everything, sort of the less smart you have to be, like the insights are still there. And readers will discover things that you didn't even imagine and that are instantly true when you hear them. And that's an incredible experience.
Oh my gosh, this makes me very excited to read your book. I can't wait. Okay, so this is a good place, I think, to start to wrap up. And the way that we end these episodes are with what we call community questions. So mm-hmm. they're questions that the Real Talk Radio listeners have asked to hear about from each guest of a given season. And so this season, we have 9 kind of fun, rapid-fiery, random questions, if you are down excellent. For that.
Sure.
Okay, so the first question, when was the last time that you tried something new, and what was it?
Oh gosh, probably it has to do with puppy training. And probably it was bringing them to the stream and putting them in the stream so they get used to water. Maybe it was extracting honey from the beehives.
Ooh, okay. That's interesting. Also, I imagine a little bit scary, but maybe not.
I've yet to be stung by a bee, and we've had beehives for 4 years, but I generally don't go into them on my own. I sort of, you know, I want to give stinging insects their space.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's a good policy. if you could take a semester-long course in any subject, what would it be?
Oh my gosh. These are hard questions. They're not just rapid fire. I think Kabbalah. I've been reading about Kabbalah. I grew up Jewish.
And that's something that you would like to learn more about. I like that.
Yep.
What's one thing that you're really passionate about that didn't come up in this conversation?
I've really gotten into finger and toenail polish, which I never used to do before. But it's a way of like being out on the trail and all my gear and still feeling like, yeah, you know, my toes are green, like having this sort of like semblance of connection to, you know, whatever that core self is that isn't out there.
What would you say has been a really big challenge or obstacle for you in the past couple of years?
Lyme disease. I got Lyme disease. I'm still being treated for it 2 years after I got it. And it makes things really hard for months at a time.
Yeah, I mean, this could be a whole other conversation.
Oh, it could be. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying like not to follow the threads because I'm like, okay, trying to be respectful of your time. But yes, that's something else that we could definitely talk about. what's one thing that you can do today that you weren't capable of a year ago?
I can talk openly about the content of my book. Mm. Not because it's out, but because I am no longer afraid of it.
Well, I feel like the process of working through, even if you had the mindset of I'm only writing this for me, like you come out of that, you know, with probably new insights and emotional clarity.
For sure. For sure. If, you know, if you hold it to high standards, like if you do it for yourself, you've still got to revise and work with readers and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. If you want to get it to the same level.
So then what's something that you hope to be able to do a year from now that you're not yet capable of or good at?
Light a fire in the wilderness in the snow.
Okay. Well, you let me know when you can do that. Okay. That's what you should like take a video, right? You're like video progress of you lighting fires in the snow.
Except for batteries don't work when it's that cold.
Oh, so yeah.
I try and then my camera dies after like one photo.
Okay. Well, someone out there invent something amazing for her to be able to do like live video streams in the Arctic.
Please write to me if you find a way to do that.
When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a visual artist, a painter.
Oh, okay. And did you ever kind of go down that path?
I don't know. Not really. You know, I don't do it much. I still like, I can draw. But I feel like that attention to detail and has just translated into a different form now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as a writer, since you're a writer, I'm particularly curious about this. Which are 2 to 3 books of any genre that you would say have had the biggest impact on you or that you have maybe enjoyed and reread the most?
The book I've reread the most is Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard. The second book I've read the most is Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, which is a very deep journalistic account of family in the Bronx, sort of the wives of drug dealers. And it is, you can't put it down. It is so dense with detail. And Behind the Beautiful Forevers, which was written by Catherine Boo about slums in Mumbai, I believe. And those two books together, the last two, I would actually pick up, I had them on my desk the whole time I was writing this book, and I would pick up one and I would just read a page, and because the detail is so spectacular, it's so specific and interesting and arresting. And I would just sort of try to internalize that sensibility before I started writing.
I love that. So when you look ahead at the next couple of months, what's something that you feel really excited about?
I'm going to do a dog-powered book tour.
A dog-powered book tour.
So we're bringing the dogs to New York City. You know, 14 dogs and a cart, and we're going to like drive around the city giving people rides and promoting the book.
That's amazing. Okay, so for people who want to find out more about that and just more about you and your work and stuff in general, what's the best place for them to do that? And maybe as far as social media goes, your favorite way to connect?
I have a website, blairbraverman.com, And that's a good way. My dog team is Mountain Dogs Racing, so you can keep up with them there too. I also use Twitter a lot, increasingly. And I am at Blair Braverman, and you'll just see so many puppies and also sometimes writing and journalism stuff.
Awesome. So I will put links to all of that stuff in the show notes. Blair, this was so much fun. Right. Thank you.
It was. I'm so happy to talk to you. You are just as lovely, quote unquote, in person as you sound on the radio.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening and for being part of the Real Talk Radio family. I couldn't do this without you. And as I said way back at the top of the episode, this is now a 100% listener-supported show. The show is made possible by people like Jessica. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Nicole. How are you?
I'm super pumped that you and I are going to play a quick three-question round of Would You Rather, my favorite game.
Ooh, yay, I'm excited too.
Okay, so would you rather never use social media ever again or never watch another movie or TV show?
Social media for sure.
Really? Okay, how come?
I used to actually work in the entertainment industry in Los Angeles, and so movies are basically my life and blood. So
I love it. I don't know which one I would pick. Oh, man. I feel like, I don't know, now I'm stressed out. I'd probably pick never to watch a movie or TV show. No, but that sounds horrible. See, that's why this game's the worst. We'll see.
I know, right?
It's terrible. Okay. Would you rather be able to teleport anywhere, anytime, or be able to read minds?
Teleport.
Yeah, me too. I honestly think the mind reading thing, I got all these would you rather questions from like various places on the internet, and the reading mind thing's reading minds comes up a lot. And I honestly don't know that I would want that. Like, I think people should be able to keep their thoughts to themselves.
I agree. And I'm not sure if I want to know everybody's thoughts.
Yeah, I'm sure I definitely don't. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the last one, would you rather never be able to cut, shave, or wax any hair on your body ever again, or never be able to use toilet paper again?
Oh my gosh. Probably toilet. No. Yeah. Toilet paper. That's so difficult.
I know. It's terrible, right?
I just can't stand the feeling of like armpit hair. So,
but I mean, I also don't know that I would love the feeling of not ever using toilet paper again. I mean, I guess it depends if I could use other things in its place, right? Like if it's that you just can't use actual toilet paper, or if you can't use anything because if you can't use anything to substitute for it, like,
I don't know.
Okay, Jessica, so why don't you introduce yourself to the rest of the listeners real quick, tell everyone where you live and one thing you're totally obsessed with right now.
Okay, so I recently just moved back to my hometown in Pensacola, Florida, and I am taking this time to spend with my family, and I'm currently working towards becoming a peace coach. And that, I guess, is a totally jumbled mixture of a bunch of things like yoga and nutrition and kind of taking life coaching to a more specific level, because I feel as though I haven't experienced enough life to be a quote unquote life coach. So I'm kind of exploring what that meaning is as far as helping others find peace. And something I'm totally obsessed with is spending time with my little sister.
Oh, what a cute answer. I love that.
Yeah.
So you are a member of our Patreon support squad, meaning that you're one of the people that listeners can thank for making the podcast possible, since you have made a small and powerful pledge that helps fund the costs of producing the show each season. So I would love for you to share why you decided to support the show and something you love about being in our little family.
Sure. So I started supporting the show because there was one particular podcast that was just so impactful from your last season that I thought there is no way I should be spending $7 on Netflix when all I do is waste time, but I should rather give money to you so that these podcasts can keep happening. And this was before the amount of money was needed to start going. And then I thought, oh my gosh, now is the perfect time. Anyway, so I just figured there's no better way to spend my time and money than on something that helps others learn.
Well, that is such a kind thing to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm curious now, which episode was it from last season that got you?
I think it was the one where you interviewed the woman who was a clown for the, like, childhood of her life, and then she became, like, a sex expert.
Yeah, Linda Mercury, yeah, the yeah. erotic novelist. Yeah, she was great, wasn't she?
Oh my gosh, it was the best podcast I've ever listened to.
It's funny, I mean, I guess this is just a weird projection thing. I wouldn't assume, oh, I'm going to talk to someone who writes erotic novels, and that it was going to be this, like, feminist truth bomb. Like, so good. Oh, I got off that call, right? Like, damn, woman, like, so much truth.
Oh, man. I agree.
I love that you loved it. So thank you so much for being brave and for joining me for this.
Thank you, Nicole. It was such a pleasure.
And to everyone listening, if you love the podcast, if you want over 20 hours of bonus content, if you want to help us reach the funding goal we need to hit in order to keep the show going beyond the end of 2016, just go to patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette to make your pledge of $8 or more for each 8-episode season. I can't tell you how much your support means to me, and I can't wait to get to know you better behind the scenes in our community. So until next time, here's a big virtual hug and a reminder that we're all just doing the best we can, and no matter what, we're in this together.